Palfrey looked blank, took a deep breath, as though he were purposely being misunderstood. "Late spring, 91, Moscow," he began, launching himself into a kind of debriefing mode. To those of us in Moscow, close to power, it had become obvious that the old Soviet Union was near collapse. The attempted coup was the beginning, and it was an engineered beginning, but that's another story. It's enough to say that the plotters tried to isolate Chairman Gorbachev in his Black Sea resort, and Yeltsin, in spite of his bronchial attacks, which required the ingestion of a lot of his favourite medicine, was on the rise. For months I'd been rooting around trying to find something of real importance in the old archives. There was interesting stuff, but limited in its appeal. You know, big footnotes to history, stuff that would get the experts writing new books, which would appeal to only a limited number of people. Kit squirmed as though the memories were uncomfortable. I was looking for something with wider drawing power. Don't know why I began to look through the religious archives, but I did. One Saturday evening when I was doing a spell as duty officer at the old headquarters, Dzerzhinsky Square, backing onto the Lubyanka prison. The statue of Iron Felix, the founding father of what finally became the KGB, was still in pride of place. So you can tell how early this happened, because the Western press all had pictures of that statue being hauled down as a front-page eye-bite, symbol of the end of an era, right? Charlie gave a curt nod, but Palfrey had his attention now. Gauntlet had a brief flash from the past. Kit Palfrey's famous lecture to the new intake of probationers. Old Kit really used to hold everyone in the palm of his tongue. "You want to know about spies?" he always began. "You want to know about intelligence operations and security exercises? Then I'll tell you. Think of the most immoral and scummish acts you can conceive. Think of the most underhanded, loathsome, offensive actions you can comprehend. Then treble it, and you'll be halfway to understanding how we operate. Forget glamour. Forget charm and luxury. Bring on the obnoxious. Exit truth. Enter lies. You are now penetrating the kingdom of the blind, the princedom of falsehoods. You have, I cannot call you ladies or gentlemen, become thieves, cheats, confidence people, perjurers, even killers. You are beneath contempt, for you have entered the secret world. Nowadays, what with new labour and political correctness, they couldn't have wheeled Kit out without causing offence. The world, Charlie considered, had turned into an era of uncomfortable touchiness. In days of yore, listening to Kit, the old hands would know that this is what he really thought of the second oldest profession, and they knew he was right, for he always drew a picture of maggot-ridden corruption that was both repugnant and, at the same time, attractive. He was exercising that talent now, painting a picture of Moscow in the spring of 91, with the snow barely melted and the tensions high. Without even trying, he managed to conjure up the nervous rumours, the whispers, even the cabal of plotters, drunk and inept. Then his search, the descent into the dank storerooms below Dzerzhinsky Square, where footsteps echoed and every movement was magnified in sound. It was a long, wide, whitewashed cell, he said, stone blocks, damp walls, rickety tables. The kind of thing you get from military surplus stores. Box upon box of green, mouldy paper. There was the evidence of the early days of Stalin's terror. Sandwiched between the first arrests of military men and the dictator's paranoia was his personal attack on religion, the sacking of churches, all done by the Cheka, which would, in the coming decades, be transmogrified into the KGB, out of the OGPU, GUGB, by way of the NKVD, etc., etc. "Mind you," Palfrey said, "there was precious little left. There were long lists, gold and silver. Chalices, patterns, pixies, monstrances, gorgeously embroidered stoles and chasubles, all detailed with the date and the name of the church from which they were plundered. And next to each item, meticulously recorded, the amount of money which the treasurer generated." This in itself was informative, for it was possible to trace the countries that had been part and parcel of transactions. The United States, Great Britain, Switzerland, Italy, Spain, Portugal. Interesting in that, following the richer countries, came the Roman Catholic states, the church almost certainly buying back what had already been plundered. Then, by the gloom of naked low-wattage light bulbs, Kit found the scrolls. The boxes were in surprisingly good condition. I was concerned for the scrolls themselves. A couple of them had damp patches, others had become brittle. He recognized the ancient Greek, but could not read it. He also reminded Gauntlet that he did have some experience in these matters, for Kit's father, like the traitor Philby's father, was an Arabist and an archaeologist. Four of the scrolls were in Greek, but one, much shorter than the others, was in Old Latin, the dead language that had been beaten into me at my snobby public school. He recalled the smell of wine cellars in rainy summer and the prep school changing rooms of childhood, damp serge and wool, and sticky armpits, the air redolent with crotch, knee joint, and arm joint tang. Tincture of sweat glands, he called it. Suddenly, in that freezing cold, barren, whited sepulchre of a place, I was reading, freely translating, even modernizing, the Latin. 2 minutes in, I prayed for it to be genuine, and found that all my senses were stretched, eyes and brain lipping over the language and its meaning, my ears straining for any noise that might signal the advance of another person into the area. I swear that I could have smelled the approach of another human. I could separate one from the rats that already scuttled around and shredded precious paper. Here. His hand went back into the briefcase, retrieving a sheaf of typewritten notes. This is what I read, but this is translated by Father Harry Jarvis, OSJ, and Father Hugh Pickles, OSJ, both men who could converse in Latin. Take it, Chuck. Read what stapled me to these documents. Gauntlet put on reading glasses. Don't really need them, but they help a little. Arranged his face into his most skeptical look and began to read, following his guiding finger along the double-spaced lines. My name is Titus Romilius, and I am a centurion of the 9th Legion, moved and attached to the Roman prefect of Judea, Pontius Pilate. I am writing this explanation as I've been summoned back to Rome, and know from Pilate that this could be a trick to replace me with another officer. For my duties have been of the most sensitive kind. Because of this, I'm adding other notes to this letter. They should help anyone reading the journals. And sure enough, there were more pages after the letter. Already, there are those here in Jerusalem who would like to see me supplanted and my work destroyed. On Pilate's instructions, I have been gathering as much information as possible on the Jewish religious teacher Jesus, who was sentenced and executed only 3 days ago. This Jesus had a large and devoted following, and the only way I could observe the man was by putting someone close to him. Originally, it was thought his followers could pose a serious threat to Roman rule. We have, over the last few years, been examining all of the terrorist groups that seem to thrive in this ripe little satrapy on the edge of civilization. Charlie cocked an eyebrow at Palfrey. Bit modern, Kit.
What?
Terrorist groups, satrapy. This fellow Romilius, the centurion, says he's been examining all the terrorist groups in Judea, which he calls a ripe little satrapy. Bit modern, isn't it, terrorist groups? The people doing the translation are trying to make the text easily understood, comprehensible in the modern age. They're very expert and dedicated men. They also know their job. Father Harry wrote the software for translating old documents. Charlie went back to the letter. For some time, when I first came to this place and started to study the Jewish people and their splinter organizations, their politics and their religion, it was best for me to be removed from their leading city, Jerusalem. So I made my camp in the town of Hebron, to the south of Jerusalem, and it was here that I met the prostitute Naomi. Naomi was born into the Jewish faith, but had fallen on hard and dangerous times, following the death of her husband James. After James died, Naomi was driven from her home and lands by the treachery of her husband's family, and she was forced to leave Ascalon on the seashore, where she'd spent most of her life. So she'd come to Hebron, still very young, some 15 or 16 years, and greatly attractive, both in face, speech, and body. Being a prostitute, she was shunned by her own people, even though Jewish men used her in secret. However, she plied her trade mainly among foreigners, particularly Roman officers. Her price was high, so she was not available to the ordinary soldier or the common man. And this was how I met her, in the pursuance of her trade. She was a warm, experienced, loving, and clean girl, so much so that I was in a mind to take her as my exclusive woman. She was intelligent and a good talker, though she could neither read nor write.